You're listening to an M Pavilion podcast. We acknowledge the people of the Eastern Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which M Pavilion stands. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to the traditional custodians of the land where you're tuning in from, around Australia and across the globe.
I'm Matt Muir. I'm a Derby man from the Wiradjuri language group, so northeast of the Wiradjuri language group in New South Wales. I was born on Yorta Yorta country, so for Shepparton, for anyone who knows where that is. I also acknowledge that I am a visitor on the Eastern Kulin country, and I'd like to pay my respects to the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people and the Bunurong Bunwurrung people of the Eastern Kulin nations in which I work and live. Yeah, that's pretty much me.
What do you do?
Oh, sorry. I work at background in architecture, and I work at Monash University within the Buildings and Property Division, looking at strategic design, master planning, and how our campuses in particular can look at referencing or looking into Indigenous knowledges, practices, and protocols, and embed that within our campus infrastructure and built environment.
Hello, all. My name's Anne-Marie Pisani. I'm a non-Indigenous landscape architect and working with Aspect Studios. I am also a visitor on this land. I live and work on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country. I'd like to pay my respect to their elders past and present, and also those of my family through my husband and my daughters. They are Gunai, Ngarrigo Monero, and I'd like to pay my respect to their elders. They come from very strong family as well, and strongly influence and share and provide me with a level of understanding, I think, and that personal connection and how I really undertake the work that I do and the way I see the place, see how we work, and I think the respect and everything I do, it's beyond my profession. It's just the way that we come together as family. I'm pretty privileged in what I do. I hold a role of First Peoples Partnerships and Design Lead, but all that means is I'm very privileged in that all the work that I do as a landscape architect is only working with traditional owners from across, mainly across Victoria, but also from other parts of this country as well. And so I'm very fortunate that I have able to work, build relationships and learn from communities, and hopefully be able to provide back a little bit back to communities in what we do. That's part of what I do is just, I think, considering what's the benefits we can deliver to community very much so in everything we do.
And you're going to have a very famous artist as a daughter, just saying. Stay tuned. Amazing. Very young, extremely talented. Won't say anymore, but watch this space. My name is Sarah Lynn Rees. I'm a Palawa woman descending from the Trawlway people of northeast Tasmania. Live and work across Wurundjeri, Bunurong, Bunurong country. I'm a visitor on these countries, but I also pay respects to the Briggs family line. So Ngawi, Carol and Briggs, we share a common ancestry, even though our lines go in different directions. Mine's in Tasmania, hers is here. Yay colonisation. So I have been very fortunate to have a connected relationship to elders from around this place, living and working here for the last, too many years. I'm getting old. It's December. I'm tired. Just forewarning. I work at Jackson Clements Burrows Architects, lecture at Monash University, and sit on far too many panels and boards, and all of which is intended to, everything is a sort of big jigsaw puzzle moving towards the agenda of indigenising the built environment.
And Sarah also just won the Vic Chapter President's Prize. Let's hear it for Sarah. Cool. What do you guys want to talk about? There was a very strict blurb for this talk, and that blurb was a little bit of a lie. we're going to take things in a slightly different direction because, as Sarah mentioned, it is the end of the year and it's been a really big year for First Nations peoples, not just in Australia but globally. And the roles that we face, we're presented with different types of... We're in different roles, but we're all presented with very similar challenges. And one of the things that I've noticed this year in particular is that phrases like country, connecting with country and caring with country are tossed around quite a lot. And it's not until you start to interrogate the people who are using these phrases that you understand that they might not really know what they mean or the power that these types of words have. They're being used as buzzwords a lot. I'm seeing that a lot on projects. And it really pisses me off. So I thought maybe we could just start with talking about country. And I thought I'd just start and with a question to whoever wants to answer it first, and then we can start a conversation or a dialogue around what is country. Who wants to kick it off?
Yeah, I'm happy to. As I said sort of previously, I was born on Yorta Yorta country, so... rural Victoria, growing up there is sort of the connection to landscape, but not just the connection to landscape, but connection to community. The Yorta Yorta community are quite large out at Shepparton, and it's the community contributions to the land and that interconnectedness between community, kinship, living, non-living things that sort of create this idea of country. Well, to me personally, but I think to what you were saying, Bradley, it's that level of understanding that I guess needs to be uplifted amongst all, I guess, built environment practitioners. It's something that I guess, as you were talking about, the people that don't necessarily have the understanding of country and the people that do, it's a imbalance in a way. And so how do you find the right people? How do you talk to the right people and how do you ensure that it's done in a respectful way? Within my particular work, I think the lands of the Eastern Kulin, I really have a deep appreciation for this country in that there is a long-standing connection to water, and that is a big thing that sort of runs throughout a lot of Indigenous communities. It's the rain that comes down the mountains that runs through the rivers and streams, and it just feeds itself back out, and in this instance goes back out to Port Phillip Bay or Nerm. So it's that real beauty and connection, not only between the tangible but the intangible.
I think it's an interesting point that you raised, Bradley, because I've been feeling the same way. Actually, a lot of our people in architecture have been feeling the same way about wanting to define and protect what designing with country and connecting with country actually mean. So much so that Danielle Hromek and I ran a Deadly German yarn at some point during the year called Lipstick on a Wombat, which alarmed a number of people until they realised it was us who were doing it. It was called Lipstick on a Wombat, Designing with Country, because so many people were just saying it and not knowing what it meant. And I think we're all quite protective of what it means for us, and we don't want it to get watered down, and it's always at risk of getting watered down. And I think I've read so many briefs this year. One of them was like, because you're on the exit road and it takes you up at a certain elevation, you can see out over the landscape, therefore you are connecting with country. And it's like, really? Okay, not sure about that. And like, I don't know. Connecting with country is almost like a benefit or a byproduct of actually healing country and working with country and designing with country in a proper way. So that's an outcome if you do the other part right, not just a reality if you somehow get up high. But I guess, sorry, spicy. But for me, country is everything, really, isn't it? It's all time, all space, all natural systems, all materials, all beings, us, everything. That's why I think it's hard for people to understand, because it is a holistic way of looking at the world.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, Sarah, about, you know, it's holistic. It encompasses everything. It's what we understand. It's from my understanding of working with communities, it's, you know, it's not just the tangible, it's the intangible that's just as important, if not more important than what you can see. It's how, is what is that connection? And I think, you know, as a non-Indigenous person, I have Itaean heritage, and many years ago I went over to Italy for the first time, yet having grown up in a very Anglo-Saxon school, not wanting to be that that small group of children that have, you know, European heritage. You wanted to fit in with everyone. And I think, you know, I sort of, I probably blocked out my heritage to a degree. And so when I went over to Italy for the first time, the connection I felt to that place when I first arrived absolutely blew my mind, because I did not expect it. I didn't think that I would have it. I've never been there. My parents came out here when they were very young. They've never been back. There's never really been that connection to that place. There's a connection to family that have all come out, but never to that place. And yet when I was there, that overwhelming sense of belonging, it threw me and really shook me emotionally. But then I sort of started just trying to understand, well, why am I so connected to this place? What is it? And just understanding, I think, you know, through the many generations of their connection to that place and their culture and their identity and what that's carried through. And I still see that in my family. And so, okay, so I'm starting to understand that a little bit. And then, so I think, you know, all of us, you know, everyone here, majority of people here are probably non-Indigenous, but you have an opportunity to really understand what that connection to country is that the Indigenous people of this place have by searching in, looking in at your own connection to where you're from, and what is that connection you have, and how can you bring that level of understanding to the work or the way that you're living and working now.
That was beautifully summarised. Thanks. I think we're done.
Yeah, I was going to say, just on the point that you, the very last point in this idea around, I think you hit the nail on the head with, I guess, this idea of connection. And I think amongst Indigenous communities, it's a lot of when you're meeting someone for the first time, it's like, who's your mob, where are you from? And that those two questions sort of lead to a ongoing conversation about where you grew up, where your family's from, your family lines, your connections, where people moved, because there's a massive history of displacement, where they moved to, where they were taken from. And you sort of understand from those conversations, in a way, you can oftentimes find connections with a lot of people that you didn't know you were connected to, or places that you didn't know you were connected to. So I think that idea around that identity and where you come from, where your family comes from, I think is, yeah.
And I think, you know, when I have conversations with community and I, you know, either talk a little bit, you know, I always make sure that I introduce myself, but not just my name and my role, bring a little bit about myself to that conversation. So I bring a little bit about my history or my connection to something or what do I find relevant. And what I find that leads into more conversation, and it's really sparks a level of interest there. Or, you know, sometimes I might bring, particularly make a piece of food that is of Italian heritage, and it just opens up a conversation and a chance to connect. And it connects on a different level, because then it invites a different level of conversation quite quickly, in a way, of sharing, of an understanding of cultures and traditions. And that's really where, you know, where it becomes some really interesting understandings and conversations that, you know, all of us who are non-Indigenous can actually do that.
Where's my Italian food? You haven't cooked for me.
It's coming.
It's really interesting that you're touching on that sense of belonging and the very real history of dispossession of land and of country. And it sort of leads me to two different places. The first that I'd love to understand is, given what your relationship and understanding of country is, how do you then explore your connection with country?
When you're not on your country or on your country?
Both.
I've talked about this before, but for me it's kind of complicated because where I'm from is either a national park that you have to pay to go into or a right of access through a land, a large block of land that leads to Batman's shack. So I can either pay to go visit country or I can go and drive through and visit the man that killed a whole lot of my ancestors' home. So, you know, complicated. And then also, like, I grew up in Tasmania, so it's sort of complicated place. A lot of people had to hide for it to be protected in that sense. Like, we had many years of resistance to colonization and genocide and war and martial law and all sorts of things. And then many generations of people, families like my own, not feeling okay to publicly talk about who we are and where we're from. We still talk about it at home, but never out loud to other people, because if you did, then you would be persecuted, even if you had light skin. So there's a whole lot of complexity there for me. And so it's actually, I don't know if this is the right thing to say, but it's actually some sort of freedom to not be on my own country and not have to, I'm not prepared yet to deal with the politics of what all of that means. I've got a lot of time. It's okay. I'll get there. I mean, I have gone back and I've physically, you know, spent time in the place as much as you can when it's a access road. It's never enough. And I would absolutely love to go back and connect with more community and spend time down there. But that's not necessarily something that's been available to me because of the way that colonisation happened in Tasmania. So since moving to Melbourne, I focused my efforts on connecting with community here, found out that I have family through different community lines here. Some of my ancestors ended up in Corranderk. So, you know, you actually, like, Tasmania Land Bridge, 10,000 years ago, you know, like, we were all connected at some point. But even recent family connections to Corranderk, for example, during colonisation. So there's, as soon as you start looking, there's connections everywhere, which is, I guess, is the main point. But that's always connection to people and a little bit of connection to place and country. But I guess in the context of architecture, because our job is fundamentally reshaping country with every project that we do, and our industry doesn't quite let us do this in a proper way yet. But for me, it's always about trying to understand who country was before country's agency was dampened by colonisation, and using a project to give that agency back. So that's agency in design, agency in representation, agency in health, agency in being able to shape and reform and reshape country in the way that country wants to. I know that sounds all abstract, but there is enough information available to us to be able to understand if a place is healthy or unhealthy, or if it's been harmed or not. And then there is a layer of cultural story and knowledge and nuance that can, that is layered in, that informs and guides how we as people should be ethically working with country. It comes from elders. But yeah, I don't know. We talk, Bradley and I talk about this a lot, existential crisis pretty much every day, because everything we do is, it still is a form of destruction of country. We haven't got there yet. We haven't got to a place where what we're doing is actually creating a net positive gain, whatever you want to call it, for country.
The other tangent that I was thinking of, and you sort of touched on it again then, which is great, because one of the things that I've been, that's been front of mind for me a lot this year, is just the interconnectedness of all of the things that we do and how familiar the issues that we're facing are, despite the very different roles that we all play within the built environment industry. And I was also, just before we go on, I know we haven't spoken a lot about architecture yet and everyone is from the AIA, but we'll get there. This is all part of it. And as Emery was saying, if you want to learn more about country and community, then you need to develop and grow your relationships with traditional owners. And that doesn't start by you going in and saying, this is my project, tell me about this place, what can I take from you? So it's part of why we're starting here. But just on the idea of country, something that really clicked and resonated for me was the idea of mnemonic memory. And I think a lot of people, well, people might have used this when you were studying. If you're studying a different language, then you like label your rice and your cereal and you go around the house and you, you know, write it all up in Spanish, and then every time you open the door, you see that word in Spanish. It's a form of mnemonic memory. It's a form of learning and understanding. Do people here know what songlines are? Sort of, maybe. Some people. Yeah? Okay. Pardon? Yeah. Songlines were, to put it simply, songlines were forms of navigating the vastness of Australia. There are really well-known stories of songlines and there are lesser-known stories of songlines where you'd sing to the country as you're travelling across the country, and within the song would change. Depending on where you are, it would reveal a story about a certain place. So it was a way of understanding and reading country. It was a way of sharing knowledge through 60,000 years. And it was a way of teaching and a way of understanding and learning country. Some of the stories about songlines, they were created by creator spirits. And to move through neighbouring countries, in some instances you would need to know the songline in language to move through that part of country if you're moving through somebody else's country. So they played a really fundamental role in how people understood, read, navigated and learned their history. Very important things. There's some really great literature available. And an example of that, I guess, in Wurundjeri Woiwurrung culture in country is the greenstone axe heads that are from a certain site have been found all the way up until Darwin, and they've only come from this one quarry site. So that's a really long way without cars and planes and horses. Anyway, sorry. But when we think of country, so the way that I try and explain it is, I don't know if everyone has this, but when you're growing up, you know, you slowly get rid of the stuff you had when you were a kid, but there might be some really important things that remind you of really special moments of when you were growing up. And I've definitely got a couple of boxes of those hidden away in the cupboard collecting dust. So imagine you take that box and you kind of like place it in meaningful places, and every day you walk the same walk and every day you see an object in the landscape that you've placed something very special from your family or your childhood at the base of that landscape. As you're walking past, you think of that and it brings back memories of when you're a child, and that might bring back smells, it might bring back sounds, it might bring back warmth of family members, it might bring back whatever it means to you. And slowly as you're walking these walks, you start to associate not with the object but with the landscape. And you're talking about the damage that colonialism had. Now imagine someone has come through and ripped apart the... blown up the waterfalls that you had placed a really significant object at, cut down all of the trees that reminded you of your grandma. It's less about people, you know, taking really significant, really important cultural things like or landscapes away, but they're actually taking away your memories, your emotions, your reminders of 60,000 years of history, things that have been really valuable to continuing your way of connecting with country and your way of connecting with culture. It's like, you know, someone hasn't come in and burned your house down. They've come in and stolen your memories. I don't really know where I was going with that, but it's just been something I've been thinking about a lot this year. It's just been front of mind, and yeah.
Very beautifully explained.
Thanks.
Have to say. Where were you going with this?
Oh, I have no idea. it came when we were having a conversation, a yarn, a few weeks ago, and you were talking about how you understand country when you're going to different places. And I know you haven't fully formed it yet, but let's give it a whirl.
Mine was from, it was just from a conversation a few weeks ago, but... on those similar things around mnemonic memories, I was sort of coming from country Victoria. It's sort of, you know, that it's quite a short in comparison to Indigenous culture, but through those generational connections to a place like a small country town, it's like everyone knows where the best fish and chip shop is. It knows how to, how I don't know where to go. It's like everyone knows there's probably three pubs. Everyone knows what the best pub is on a certain day, how to get there without maps, everything like that. Everyone knows, I take it back to my childhood in going to the school bus. There was a particular street you wouldn't go down from the months of August to October because the magpies would obliterate you. It's those sorts of things around, I guess, referencing it from I don't know how you would describe it, like a country output, but it's it's similar feelings in that connectedness to a place where, things, and then I think to similar to yours, it's being removed from that place and coming back and realising that the fish and chip shop's gone and it's been replaced by Woolworths or all these types of things that you had that connectedness to. And it just, you kind of struggle with being able to advocate for those places when it doesn't remind you of the same things or the same connections that you once had. And I think that comes down to, I think a lot of the themes around, I guess, intergenerational trauma that happens amongst communities and that idea that someone might be, for instance, Wiradjuri or Yorta Yorta, I'm using those examples from my own personal output, but maybe living on Bunwurrung country or haven't grown up on country. So, yeah, it's in very early development.
Sorry, throw you on a bus.
Yeah, that's a bit of a research thing that I want to explore. But, it's those similar things around what you're talking about is it's having memories embedded in places and then having those places ultimately removed or changed, which can then alter your own connection to place.
Well, I think it's a great analogy because we can all relate to that experience.
I was going to say the next step, and this isn't my story. I think I can't remember who the speaker was, but it was at Living Cities Forum, and they were talking about the naturalisation of waterways, and because they had a Dutch colonial process, that meant that there were concrete walls, and that the sort of the next step from the stories that you're talking about is actually being able to relate and know a river in a certain way. And I think the speaker was talking about the idea that, and I've heard elders talk about it here too, that like when the water gets to a certain level or is rising in a certain way or it hits a bank in a certain way and moves off or there's a different colour or like there's just these little changes that happen, you know what's coming because you have that relationship with that river as if it's your friend, you can read it. And that's where we get into the idea of reading country and being able to understand country's needs and how do we predict and work with country in the way that country needs. In this context, country, I'm talking about a river. But it's sort of all these building blocks that like imagine thousands of generations of community having relationship through kinship to and responsibilities to different places, being able to collectively bring together all of that knowledge to understand what country needs. Like, it's so powerful. And just, like, why it's not respected, I have absolutely no idea. It's so sophisticated.
And I might just sort of add to that and almost go sideways tangent, but I think, you know, in regards to sort of the song lines, the understanding, but you know, the reading of country in particular, something I've been thinking of, again, working with a community in Far East Gippsland and really being able to walk a part of their country, which is pretty extensive, but we walked every part of that with the traditional owners. So they knew the song line. They shared what was appropriate to share with us and what wasn't, but the knowledge that they shared with us, I think, as well, it was about understanding and reading country and to help us help community and develop the project. And so, you know, that understanding of country and being able to walk country with them over a number of days across a decent time frame that we had, but for us just to understand that. And then when we came through to developing some plans for it about the uses of that space and where people should and shouldn't access, we're sort of saying, well, you know, what should we identify here? Because some of these places, we know there's cultural heritage in these places that we shouldn't be touching, and we know it's also not appropriate for us to know where those places are. And the community have said, no, you draw up what you think needs to be undertaken, then you send it through to us, we'll review it, and we'll mark up any changes for you of anything that you haven't we need to remove anything. We said, okay, that's great. We undertook that process. We forwarded the plans to community, and then they came back and we sort of looked and thought, okay, so how much do we need to mark up here? And we're a bit puzzled because there weren't any marks on any of the plans. And so I've contacted them. I said, have you sent us the right version? Because there's nothing here. And they said, no. And we said, okay. And they said, no, you have really listened to the conversations that we had when we were out on country. And they said, you've really taken that on. And so the plans that you've provided us have actually avoided all those areas that you shouldn't have been near. And I think, you know, we sort of took it as upon ourselves. I was like, wow, okay, because we did. After walking with community, we went and drew the plans, but when we're on site, we're sort of staying there and trying to read country and thinking, okay, well, if this place, what is this place? This could be more of a vantage of viewpoints. Okay, that's fine. Or is this a place maybe that might have been a place that of eating, of there might be middens here as well, or, you know, there might even be burials nearby. You know, if you read the landscape, if you look at the vegetation, you understand what that vegetation is telling you, what the possible uses of that country are in that place. And if you start understanding that and then you look at the landscape very differently and you look at it in regards to what the uses or how you would have used that place, that can really influence the way that you work with that place, even architecture. Okay, I'm a landscape architect, but even it's just as relevant to architecture. Is it a siting of a place for that building? Is it the way that informs your design of that building? There's all just – so that reading of landscape is so critical, I think, to the what it is that the way we need to design with.
And I think there was two really important points there. It was from Sarah's it's a community knowledge. A community that has one collective knowledge. It's not each individual person has the knowledge of a community. In an Indigenous community, there's knowledge holders. So one specific person or one specific group of people had one knowledge set to one particular thing, and it was on the broader community to bring that together for a collective understanding. And then on the second point, it was time on country. And I think when it comes down to, I think, the theme of traditional owner engagement within the scope of projects, it's allowing for time to be able to be on country, have that on country experience, but that lengthy engagement processes that engage not just once for 1 hour and a half session and remove it from a transactional model and build relationships, because you'll find that, and it's not just, I'm 25, so my career is very short and I don't have a lot of answers, but that relationship builds over time and you will slowly be drip-fed this idea of what country is. So, yeah, it's, you might have one traditional owner engagement session where there might be, for instance, three people, and then you'll go do it a couple of months later and it'll be three completely different people, and you'll have, in a project sense, a completely different idea about what to design. So it's, yeah, allowing for that time for impactful engagement and that time spent on country in which you're engaging on.
Well, I thought of the next step for your analogy. You talked about the fish and chip shop. Maybe you should change that to like a local grocer who does seasonal produce, and it changes all the time every time you go back based on the seasons and what's available, and say it's native food. And then you put in the Woolworths and it's all the same all the year round, because they get stuff from all over the world, and all of a sudden you've lost that connection to where you are and what's available in the place that you're in. There you go.
Beautiful. And if anyone else heard that, then it was my idea first.
It is yours. I give it to you.
Oh, that's kind of the beauty of having these conversations in this setting and in this way. I think thanks for everyone for sitting. We're not done yet. I'm just acknowledging that we're sitting in a circle and it's a different way of holding a conversation and holding a space. And I think one of the great things about what I've learned from Sarah is that when you hold conversations in these ways, I know we're sitting here with mics, but rather than having got somebody on a stage or putting somebody on a pedestal, it kind of invites everybody in. And it's just a much more natural way of having a conversation rather than the moderator panelist thing. Before we go on, to my next question as the moderator. You've all mentioned a couple of words which people here might not be familiar with. I was hoping that you could all jump in and just explain things like, what is traditional knowledge? What is kinship? What are protocols? And it doesn't have to be perfect. It's just part of a conversation. But those words are coming up a lot. And I think it's important for non-Indigenous people to know what they might mean. Who wants to go first?
I'll take kinship.
Matt, you go kinship.
I'll lightly touch on kinship because it's quite... So I've got a 15-month-old son. So my partner, she's Wambo Amba, Brap Rapper, Tunurong. I think that this idea of kinship is, the family structure. So my son's pop calls him, my son's pop calls him pop, and then my son will call pop, grandson. It's hard to, determine, but it just defines a relationship rather than, it's quite a hard thing to, describe, but it's identified in the way that, it identifies the connection that you have to your broader family rather than just your connection to that one person. So when you have things for traditional owner sense in calling someone auntie or uncle, it's like a senior person, and it's a sort of that way of providing respect. So a family member who I might be their uncle wouldn't call me uncle for the sake of because I'm their uncle. It would be a different connotation. But Sarah, I'm happy for you to elaborate more.
Yeah, I was going to say, building on what you're saying, Matt, it's sort of different all across the country as well. There is no one way of doing it. And I don't know much about where I'm from, but here, there's actually three ways of looking at it. I think there's the sort of kinship in the context of moiety and responsibility and relationship to certain line. There's kinship in the context of how you relate to, and they're all interconnected, but kinship in how we might relate to each other. And then kinship in terms of responsibility for country. Like they're the three that sort of, they vary, but if you're in Yuendumu, Walpuri community, like the skin names, sort of one of the things that you're talking about, this idea that when you're born into a sort of 8-tier structure, and and there's a male and a female version of every name, and they sort of work in opposite directions, and it's a very, very complicated and beautiful system. But the idea is that I might be given a skin name, which means that I am your cousin, even though we might not actually be cousins in a Western context, which is exactly what you're saying. And you might be my mum, but you didn't give birth to me. And so there's this whole system of how a community comes together and looks after each other. It's largely modelled on the idea of avoiding incest also, let's be honest and real, because in that context there's always 5 generations of separation between your first choice marriage, second choice marriage, third choice marriage. So ideally 8 generations, but there's 5. Sorry, I'm going off on a little bit of a nerdy tangent. But but that's one community, whereas here you sort of – sorry. There's sort of 2 ways of looking at it. There's Bunjil and Wa, and that has a different structure again. But I guess the one that I always find super interesting is the kinship relationship and responsibility to country, like your totem, and what that means for you in the context of looking after a place. And when I talk about a community coming together to make a decision for a place, it's because you're a frog. I know you're a frog. I'm a magpie. I don't know what you might be. Don't know. Haven't figured you out yet. I don't know. I'm making it up. But the point is that if we had to make a decision for a waterway, okay, we've got a frog, we've got a magpie, we might have an owl, and we might have an eel, and we would all come together because we have a relationship with that particular animal, and our responsibility to that animal is to know it inside out and know its needs and know its behaviours. And if we're going to make a decision for country, then we need to make sure all the right people that are connected and in relationship with the different animals or waterways or trees or systems that exist in that place will come together to make that decision. Now, that doesn't happen now. in the context of traditional letter engagement in architecture, right? Like, it just doesn't happen.
We're trying to change that.
Yes, we are. But you might end up engaging with one elder or representatives from three family groups or whatever it might be, but they're not necessarily the people that hold the knowledge or the relationship or the responsibility to look after a certain place. So, I don't know, we've got a long way to go and a lot of systems to rebuild and a lot of structures to galvanise how things can be done in the right way, but we're inching forward. I said a lot more terms. Sorry.
I was about to say. Need a dictionary. I think you sort of covered off protocols and traditional knowledge in a sense too, in some ways.
Protocols are, like, in a contemporary sense, I'd say protocols are behaviour. Like, you can, some communities have their protocols on their websites, like Larrakia has protocols for working with them on their website. A lot of country plans, so a lot of Victorian Aboriginal communities have country plans that include their protocols. And, I mean, it would be great if there were protocols for what it meant to work on their country in terms of reshaping their country, but that's something that comes out through the process of engagement in the context of the built environment. But it's behavioural and responsibility and rights and knowing where you fit in the context of a community and how you need to behave in that context, which also comes back to kinship and also comes back to everything. Like, if I go to Yundamu, I've got a skin name, which fits me in the community, even though I wasn't born there. Like, that's something that was given to me at that point in time because I spent so much time there. But, like, that's how it works. You sort of fit into a system in a certain way.
And the reason why I wanted to have that conversation first is because the next phrase that gets brought up a lot in our industry, other than connecting with country, is caring for country. I've seen many different interpretations of what caring for country means and many different ways that people apply it to projects. And they always fascinate me because of the way that they interpret the idea of what caring for country is. I was just wondering if the...
Give us an example. Don't name the project. Give us an example.
I'll get in trouble.
No, just like don't name the project. Just like, you know, once upon a time, I saw this thing written in a document.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe we get everyone to say where they work first before. Who you are, where you work, where you're from.
So I was working on a project and someone said that they are using caring for country as a means to make sure that there's as little material used on a project as possible. And that was the only interpretation and understanding of caring for country that was being applied to this project, which is a very, very big project. And there's many, 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 many more opportunities, but and there's traditional owner engagement, but they hadn't been in conversation with them about what a specific mob's understanding of care for country is in this place and how they would enable and enact care for country.
I think, not to answer the question, but you brought up a very important point, I think, is that I don't know how to describe it, and I think there's a psychological term for this, but it's like I think it's cyclical learning. Like, you learn something, you go through the process, and then you forget what you've learned and you reapply that, and you go to, in this case, a project with a brand new, or like a completely, I guess, flatline understanding. I think it's the same with engaging with country. It varies from project to project and community to community. Don't think just because you did it in one project in a particular context that gives you the knowledge to be able to go and implement the same strategies and the same, I guess, architectural response in a completely different setting with a completely different traditional owner group, because their values, rights and laws, thanks Sarah for that one, may be completely different, and it could be a very problematic response. So it's having this idea around going into each individual project open to learning, and that your ego is left at the door. I know for architects and designers, we like to put our names on everything, and to be able to, I guess, really market ourselves for what we do. But in the sense of traditional owner engagement and designing with country, you sort of have to be right at the back of the line, I think. So,
yeah, your voice almost matters at least. Do you want to answer the question?
You start and I'll keep
going. No, landscape architect, go on.
I think what you were going to talk about to you, and I'll just talk about caring for country. I think landscape architects see it maybe in a different way than architects, because landscape for us, country is our canvas, or the country is our canvas. And so we owe it to country to ensure that we understand country and care for country in the approach to what it is that we're doing. We also understand that we are just a visitor here, and it is just we are just here for a short term. We have many generations to follow, and, you know, we really need to understand that the long-term health and well-being of country, what we do now is going to be a legacy for that. So the interventions that we do now, how we work that landscape, so as architecture, you know, whether there's excavations, everything that we do with that now, it's for the future. And so we need to understand what that's going to mean to country in the future and what it's going to mean to communities in the future as well. And I think the way we look at it as well is it's about, I think as Sarah mentioned before, it's about understanding what is every element of it. So what is it? How can we protect and how can we help speak, give voice to the critters that don't have a voice, so as to speak? So, you know, how do we speak for the frog who can't speak for itself? How do we speak for the animals? How can we provide a sustainable ongoing habitat for them in what is a very much an urban environment? How can we develop architecture, urban design, undertake major master planning, major urban design works, but understanding this is still all on country. There are animals across all of this. If we put a major path through an area, we need to understand that an animal may have had their habitat, pathway crossing in one direction. We're going to open that up and put a path right through there, which then means that they're more vulnerable for when they're crossing that path. There's a lot more light. There's more potential for predators for them. So we need to understand everything that we do has an impact on country. So I think, to me, it's every little step that we do. What does that mean to country? How do we enact? How do we understand that? And what do we need to do to ensure that we've really desecrated country so much. How can we change that around?
Would you say that decentering humans is a big part of your process? Would you say that decentering humans is a big part of your process?
Definitely. So, you know, and the way that we see things a lot of times, we're designing architecture. Who's that being designed for?
Mm.
Humans. Urban design, who's that for?
Mm.
Where are we now?
Cars.
Who's this designed for? That's right. We need to flip that understanding in the opposite direction.
I think one way of maybe changing the way people look at this is understanding that country has the right to care for itself or herself, and that all we have done as humans is actually take away that capacity. And a large part of what is actually we have the capacity to actually do in the built environment is to give that agency back. Where's a little bandicoot running around making a little conical shape with its nose that a seed drops in from a tree that the little fungi on the roots feeds on, and blah, 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 blah. Like all these things, all of these natural systems are every element of country working in a system to care for that country. And we come along and, we have a fairly light touch. Yes, we did manage country, and yes, we are trying to bring those practices back. Like Coolburns is one of them. It's probably the one that gets the most traction in this context. But it's not about trying to dominate it. It's about understanding that actually, hey, if we do this, then country is actually healthier in this context. But yeah, I don't know. Like that's so I try and like we always try and ask the question. And I know that we're in quite an infant stage of this because we weren't taught about how to care for animals in the context of architecture. But you know, what is it like? We talk about gender sensitive urban design. It's like, where's the possum sensitive urban design? Like, where are all these things? Like, where are all of the elements of country that should be in this space, not just the goddamn plane trees and people and cars and giant pipes full of water? Like, what are all the things that we actually should be caring for in a place, and how do we care for them? And I think that's more exciting.
I think there's
it's a much more fun. Sorry, it's a much funner way of thinking about a project too.
Sorry. There's a traditional line I work with often, and he sort of says, you know, it's do no harm. Ensure what you're doing to do no harm. So, okay, how do we? And I think that's something we need to take on is, okay, how can we undertake this project by doing no harm? So what is it that we need to consider? And, you know, I think our processes, we need to relook at our processes.
It's also not just us, it's everyone. And this is where I think the interconnectedness comes from that you're alluding to before. It's okay, and it's kind of funny because my dad's a builder and he'll like complain about all this architect doing these things, taking up all this time. We get no time to build it. And I'm like, this client taking up all the time, making a decision on who they want to do the project and cutting our program by 4 months. Can't design it properly. Builder gets annoyed because we haven't documented it properly. What a surprise. And then the people who are doing the business case taking a really long time to pick. Like it all goes up the chain, and I feel like we all need to go and have a meeting with Department of Treasury and Finance and figure out what's going on there at the start, and maybe change some of those documents because we all know I'm obsessed with systemic change. But like, who makes the decisions, I guess, is the interesting one, and what do they know about country, and like, how do we talk to them? Because we've said this a million times, but by the time it gets to us, we're working an uphill battle. We still can do things, obviously, but it's incremental and it's little wins rather than fundamentally reshaping the way we do something.
I think, I agree. Systemic change is very important. I know that you're quite interested in amending planning law. One of the areas that we're trying to implement systemic change is in the way that architecture is taught. And I thought, before we get too far into that, we've talked about what country is. We've talked about what our understanding of connecting with country and caring for country is. I'd be really curious to know from all of you what you learned at Architecture and Landscape University about what First Nations perspectives are, what our history of architecture of country is. And we're not starting with you, Matt, sorry, because...
Don't do me dirty, Matt. I was Matt's teacher.
I know from my perspective, I was taught absolutely nothing. Everything that I learned comes from kinship relationships and from family and from having conversations with other First Nations people in the industry, outside of the industry. Something that you find really interesting, or that I found really interesting, is that I've got family working in social justice, family working in art, family working in law, and core values are still centered around country, culture, and community. And that's the first place that we start on any project. Even though our disciplines are so different, it comes back to the same place. But when I was at architecture school, history started with Greek architecture. I think we talked about the pyramids a little bit.
We had the ziggurats.
Yeah. I think we talked about Stonehenge a little bit. And then, I don't know, it all ended up with critical regionalism. It all ended up with critical regionalism, and that's kind of where architecture's reached. But we didn't learn anything about the history of the architecture of country, history of the continent now called Australia. So that's what I learned. Not much.
We had 5 minutes in a history class once about traditional shelters. And then I was that annoying student, surprise, surprise, that would just annoy my tutors. I'm very sorry to all of them, actually not really, but and try and understand and bring country or understanding of country, if it was geology or ecology or whatever it was, into the projects I was working on, or even a value that I'd heard from a story, not the story itself because that's not okay, but the values. And they'd all just be like, thank you, not know what to do with it. And like you understand, I understand why now, but at the time I was a petulant young 20-something wanting to be angry at the world. But no, nothing. Yeah.
There was not really anything taught in subjects as such. There was an opportunity to do design studios or a design studio in the course. And that was taught by an American lecturer who came over here at that time, Jim Sinatra, who I was very fortunate to study under. He developed strong connections with the Glaribaloo people in Broome. And that was, to me, that was a really interesting, I was in first year and I thought, wow, you know, I was really starting to become interested in understanding this a little bit more. And so had the opportunity, so as a student had the opportunity to undertake a songline walk with the Glaribaloo people of Broome. So it was a 10-day walk in Broome. I thought, great, this sounds really interesting. I want to do this. There's nothing offered here. And so a few students, we went over. And we were about to start the walk and I was so excited and I thought, I don't know if I can do this. You know, I'm on country that I do not know, of people in a culture that I know nothing about. It's the first time I've been to Western Australia. And I was really so far out of my comfort zone. I undertook the walk and just learned so much about levels of bias that we all have. To me, that was something that was really important, so understanding what they were and just trying to peel them back. And to me, that was the biggest influence I could have done. Putting myself in a situation that I had no connection to, I was so, like I said, I was so far out of my comfort zone that there was nothing I could grasp onto, and I just fully was open to everything I was learning. And that to me was probably one of the biggest influences I had. I mean, since then, obviously, I've got a personal connection to family and I'm lucky, so I'm interested professionally and personally. But
that's where you met your husband?
He studied at uni as well. But back then, you know, the courses weren't really geared to having to the interest of Aboriginal students. It was very theoretical. It just wasn't what they sort of saw. So, but yes.
So one of the reasons why Matt's going last you're talking about planning change, you're talking about systemic change. People here might know that the National Standard of Competence for Architecture for Architects has recently changed. So there's 8 competencies that universities have to teach now. And it has recently been enforced. And Matt, you're a recent graduate.
Not quite, but yeah. And I think I'm on the light at the end of the tunnel, as I'd say. But, through my experience, I guess, I started in 2017, which was for my bachelor's, and then there was sort of very little, I guess, designing with country or Indigenous engagement as a whole. As a whole. And then sort of as I got into a master's and Sarah came on board and Bradley at Monash Uni, there was a massive change in this, I guess, not only just the representation within the curriculum, but Indigenous architects, which are very hard to come by, and they're all over Monash University, so I'm very happy to plug that in there. But and I think that, and similar to what's been talked about is, and I think the reason as to why a lot of you are here is that there's people that want to engage in the space and who are very forthcoming in wanting to engage, but just from the panel that's here, and then just throughout, I guess, the industry as a whole, there aren't many people who have the tools or the knowledge to be able to advocate in those spaces. I don't know the exact number of registered Indigenous architects, but it's very, very small. And to be able to make change, it is a cultural burden that not a lot of people should take on. But trailblazers like Sarah and Bradley, they take on a lot, and an end result is people like myself who are able to go through these degrees and feel that I guess, that little bit of cultural safety and being able to, I guess, see the next steps in architecture, because it's a hard place to be in, just Indigenous, non-Indigenous. The coursework is a struggle. The studio work is painful. To be able to be represented within the space, it's a fantastic thing. And now that universities are rolling this out and making a priority in their coursework, I think it's a really good indicator of what's to come. And only with time, more Indigenous architects and more Indigenous graduates of architecture, more Indigenous just students and people who are engaging in the space. So, yeah, it's a bit of a positive to take away from it, from my perspective. So.
I think we've always said when we were talking about the NSCA and changing the curriculum, it's going to take like 10 years for whatever we wrote in that document to actually be taught in a way that is useful fundamentally across the board. So it's it is in a sort of strange transition time, and I'm glad Matt didn't do me dirty, because he the subject I taught Matt for was a crash course in like all eight competencies, going, how are we going to teach this? Let's just go mad and try everything. And it was quite a lot. I'm sorry. I don't know. Like, everything takes time. And like my elders say to me, like, hurry up and walk. You know, get there, get your mind there. But then when you're there, just tread lightly. Because if you keep running, then, God, it's never going to work.
So we're finally up to the topic of architecture. It's only taken us an hour and 15 minutes. Thanks for bearing with us. One of the things that I find really interesting when people talk about the history of colonisation in Australia, obviously there was this idea of terra nullius, people not understanding or reading the inherent architecture of country. We've sort of touched on that with things like songlines, mnemonic memory and landscapes, so the architecture was a country. I think architects are always pretty obsessed with like the idea of genus loci, spirit of place, and with vernacular architecture. And one of the things that I was always taught at uni until fourth and fifth year, when went to UQ and Paul Memmott was there and he's body genius. But first to third year, you know, there's no real history of architecture in Australia, but that's a lie. And as an example, a quick example of local vernacular architecture, Wurundjeri people used bark from a stringy bark, and they built them in a triangular way. The stringy bark kind of interlocked in a sawtooth fashion, and then on one of the sides they lined it with leaves of a certain type of tree, and then the other side was muds. The ground was in possum skin, so there's a bunch of materials that were erected in a way that protected them from wind, heat and cold. And then just across, not too far away, Wadawurrung people, different country, different materials available, lots of stones. They built a dome-shaped stone up until a datum of about 700, and then they put a different species of bark on top. So it's a completely different shape, completely different material. They responded to a completely different context that used material of place. So this idea that we don't have vernacular architecture in our country is, I guess, just a perpetuation of the idea of terra nullius. And why I'm leading us in this direction is that, Sarah, you talk about when you start a project and the act of terra nullius. And drawing on a blank piece of paper.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, stop drawing on blank pieces of paper, because there is no context. It's an act of terra nullius. Yes, that was my rather spicy line from the national conference.
It was great.
I don't know. So I think it's a byproduct of how we're taught to think in architecture school, where it's sort of you've got carte blanche, terra nullius. You can do whatever you want. And then you actually get into the real life of architecture and you realize that there are 1,000 parameters and people actually pay for things and et cetera, et cetera. And then you get to like an old white man version of architecture where you've like done all these things and then people just give you jobs and they're like the best jobs. And then you start to draw on blank pieces of white paper. And it's like, God, the ego. My God, the ego. to think that, and like, okay, you can choose what context you put on the piece of paper, right? Like, if you don't want to draw an alignment with the roads because they're a colonial structure, then don't put the roads on. If you don't want to, if you want to design an alignment with a creek or the way that water runs through a place or whatever it is, then put that on. Like, you choose the context that you are referencing when you're designing something, which leads me to my other favourite line of neighbourhood character must die, because, God, that is watered-down versions of colonial architecture and it's a perpetuation of the whole system. I don't know why I'm talking about this. You led me in a direction that
I don't know.
Yeah, cool. Yep. Stop drawing on blank pieces of paper. Well, it's like, how can you divorce yourself from the context? And okay, the context is fundamentally shifted, but then, like, what we try and do is we try and do all the research to understand how a place was, like I said before, like who country was before colonization happened and planning and architecture destroyed so many things. And draw that and start from there. And then layer in the parameters of the things that you can't avoid in a modern context or in a contemporary context. But like just starting from a place that where the systems were connected and the place was healthy and designing with that. Yes, it's an interpretation because it's not physically there, but it's a much better place to start from.
We had a project not too distant ago. We were looking at the designing a small master plan for residential and amongst other things. But what we looked at, the first thing we looked at was understanding. So as a landscape architect, we undertake site analysis, understanding the site, you know, under geology, all systems. But even before that, we actually said, we're just going to park that for a moment. We're just going to look at this place and understand what is the connection of this place to community. And we're engaging with community about that, about what is that connection. And what we first looked at was not necessarily the song lines, but what was some significant cultural heritage on the site and what were the connections that people had on that site and where did they walk to? There was water, there was scar trees. So where would they have walked to? Where would they walk from? What was beyond the site? How did they connect through that site? That's where we started at. And then we built everything else on top of that. So we started with trying to understand country.
We started with relationality and then built from there.
What's that? What's relationality?
I've answered too many questions. Somebody else have a go.
I think from, and I learned this in Sarah's class, I think, the idea of, I guess, relationality, and I think from a mapping context as well, and the hot topic at the moment just within this context is this idea of traditional owner engagement being a lengthy wait. But there are things that you can do that prior to any sort of project, prior to any sort of engagement, is understand the relationality between the natural elements of country, and and these are resources that are all readily available. It's looking at the geology and then the EVCs that sit on top of that. Obviously, there's not a lot left, but it's looking at that. It's looking at the flora and fauna patterns of particular places, and then it's looking at the astronomy as well. And it's speaking to those sorts of things. And all of this within an architectural context can be done within site analysis, and it's a big thing that I'm doing at the moment. But it's, you then see, I guess, the soil types that supported different types of growth, the water that ran through that particular site. Like, all of the southeast context was a massive wetland. And it's those sorts of things, I guess, with the colonialism, this idea of having to dominate the landscape or to dominate country, things like creating man-made rivers to dredge out the water, cutting down old growth trees for just the sake of it, and the timber use in construction. Where I was going with that is it all can be mapped prior to this sort of level of engagement, and you can begin to understand why things are the way they are. It's because there's lots of water in a particular place, there's a particular soil, water a constant relationship between water and geology created the forms of like the Birrarung or the Werribee River or those sorts of systems. So it's once you get, I guess, once it's all mapped out and sitting within the one thing, you can sort of begin to get a baseline understanding of, I guess, what country is from a natural sense. And then when you get your appointment with traditional owners, I think it's about a 6-month wait now. But it's, yeah, you can go in and have meaningful conversations. And, yeah, that's...
I think what you... that was beautifully described. Well done. And the both of you are speaking about the same thing from different directions. So you're talking about starting with the stories and the relationship of humans to places and how those little treasures from your treasure box are actually in the built environment. Oh, not the built environment, in the environment, and mapping those because that's where you started the conversation. And then, Matt, you're talking about not being able to start with a conversation, so you start with what you can. And I think it's beautiful, and you can go in any direction. And, like, you know, there's no rules. There are rules, but there's no rules.
But we like effort. I speak for a lot of TOs. I'm not a traditional owner here, but I think going in with a genuine intent and genuine, I guess, a foundational level understanding, and going in with that a level of respect to be able to say that their opinions are valued and the work that you are doing is trying to uplift their knowledge, their practices, their laws, their values. So, yeah, it's just, I guess, building that foundation in your spare time.
Or make it part of your job and your processes.
It becomes a natural part of your processes when you're looking at a new project. We all do start analysis. We all start a project with start analysis. If we can just introduce a different way of reading or understanding a site, then it'll just form part of your processes.
Yeah, no more circles with it takes 5 minutes to walk this much this far.
Here's the closest train station. And
No, they're very important too. It's all important.
It is all important.
It is. You talk about the word that I can't say, plurality.
Plurality.
Yeah, that one. just know we've got about 10 minutes left. Before we go, one of the things that I wanted to say was just what I learn constantly from traditional owners and what I found to be common, not just in First Nations communities in Australia, but First Nation, like the Sami people, First Nations communities in Canada, is two very familiar, very similar expressions. And the first is the idea of if we care for country, it'll care for us. And the second is you got two ears and one mouth, so listen twice as much as you speak. And I think they're just really beautiful lessons to learn and to take with you, not just on your projects that you're doing, but whatever you're working on, whatever you're doing in your life. We've got about 10 minutes left. Do you guys feel like answering any questions? Yeah? If they're good questions? Yeah, okay. Does anyone have any questions? And if no one goes first, then Dan's asking a question. Yeah.
Thank you. That was an awesome presentation. I will own up that I wrote the description for tonight's thing, so I'm the one who wrote the lie. So I'm going to go back over that and I'll correct what I stuffed up, because I'm also at the beginning of my whole journey in this process. I think it's a huge upgrade for what we can deliver in Australia, so I'm at the very beginning of my journey as well. I'm on a part of a task force with the VBA looking at documentation, and we talk about it's a minimum standard guideline that we're working on, and we had a huge debate for a long time about minimum standard. We're making a guideline for minimum standards or best practice. If we're thinking about designing for country and we want to start doing better and embodying that in our processes, what do you think would be the best minimum standard for buildings in Australia to have embedded in our actual architecture that shows that we have a better understanding of designing for country?
Embedded in a document, a process, a built, like which...
In the
which
actual part? Architecture.
There's probably multiple ways to answer this, but I think if you could read country through architecture, that would be pretty great. If the seasons of place weren't... if architecture didn't stop the seasonality of place from happening, that would be great. if somehow our built environment taught us about the values of the place that we live in, a bit more abstract, less literal, but in the manifestation of the architecture, if that architecture is born from those values, that would be pretty great. I could probably go on. I'll stop.
It's sort of the idea of architecture telling you where you are, not who you are. Yeah.
Architecture to be of that place, to respond to that place, and to have for that understanding to be embedded in the design process rather than just applied.
But it's really challenging from the perspective that you're talking about it from, like being embedded in planning or in a – it's – yeah, that's quite a challenging thing to do.
Oh, planning, let me add it. Values, rights and laws of country in planning. My God. They're all such local context. Like the actual planning documents are so specific to a certain place. Why can't we engage with the traditional custodians to understand what our responsibility is to country in that place and put it in that document? Yes, it would take a long time. Yes, it's a big project. But then at least people would have the direction directly from traditional owners in the context of planning law about how they should behave and what they are responsible for in that place. Why not?
Advocate for that. Because it's scary.
But it's not. Isn't having rules better than not?
No.
I think it is.
No, I think so, yeah.
Especially if you can't engage with the traditional custodians on a project, at least you know what your responsibility is to that place. It would be liberating. And I think we would see the most widespread change, which is why I hamper on about it so much. Change planning law.
Thanks for a great conversation, guys. I've really enjoyed it from beginning to end. And I'm going to ask a question that goes all the way back to the beginning. You were talking about your annoyance with people misusing the terms of caring for country and connecting with country, and I can perfectly understand that. Even as a non-Indigenous person, you just start to hear it so frequently it becomes diluted. But I wonder what the balance is then with allowing people to not to co-opt it, but to try their very best to engage with it in all parts of their lives, even when they don't know what it means and they don't know what they're talking about. But I suspect that while some people might use the term cynically, a lot of people are enthusiastically, you know, doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah, it's a good point. I'm pessimistically optimistic. Depending on the day. I think part of the reason why I wanted to start the conversation by talking about all of our perspectives on connection with country and caring for country was to give a broader understanding on what those types of phrases mean to Indigenous people. And I think it was, another Daniel Umrek says that the idea of connection with country is about as clear as mud. It's very different for a very different mob in all different places. You know, there's the 200 different countries across Australia. They've all got their own laws and rights. They have their own methods of caring for country, their own systems, their own kinship relationships, their own practices for connecting with country. And I absolutely don't pretend to understand or know all of them. But I think just approaching them, you know, with, I guess, trying to be a little bit humble about how you approach those types of topics and just ask, like, questions. I think developing relationships, what we were talking about at the start, is so crucial to any kind of traditional owner engagement, or if you're getting to know mob, who are you, where are you from, where you come from, who's your mob. A lot of our practices go back to getting to know each other first, being pretty open and transparent, and starting to develop relationships. And I think it's kind of similar to the way that I go about trying to understand what connecting with country or caring for country is for different people. We all can practice caring for country. But I think the annoyance for me is just when people use it and then you try to have a conversation about it. And maybe there's an apprehension of having a conversation about it, or like just be open and upfront, just be honest. Like, this is where I'm at on my journey. Like you were just then, it was beautiful. You know, you, some people are at the beginning of understanding their journey of connecting with country. And it's a constantly evolving journey.
I think the other thing to say is that they like designing with country, not for country, designing with country, caring for country, they're terms that some have definitions, some don't. Some definitions are in the works so we can protect them. Stay tuned. There are other things that you can call it. Like you can call it understanding country. Like if we can't engage with traditional owners on a project, we'll quite often do an understanding country report, which is those tangible aspects of country, because we're not claiming that we're designing with country in that context because it's not holistic. And so like it doesn't have to be any of those terms. It can be more honest, I think, is the point that you're trying to make.
Yes, thank you. You said it much more succinctly than I did.
I think the problem with anything in any Indigenous context is that in a Western context, it's not so awful to co-opt things. And whereas in an Indigenous context, we're like hyper-vigilant to that shit because it's been done so many times and misused in so many ways that if you call it designing with country and it's rising you up on a freaking roadway so you can see see the landscape, or I can't remember the example that you gave before, like that's not designing with country. Like designing with country is understanding what country needs and then allowing an architecture to grow from that need and in the context and the purpose of what the project needs to be, and allowing all of those things to coexist harmoniously without destroying a system, in my opinion. That's my definition. And I have not worked on a project yet that's been able to do that. So, you know, that's where we're at. We're not there yet.
I think it's important to keep in mind that a lot of the things that we talk about and the reason why we're in this constant existential crisis is because it's really hard to practice everything that we want to be practicing because there aren't systems in place to allow us to do it. But I've also been told that it's quite important to be aspirational about these things, and we'd probably rather be aspirational about them and fight for systemic change and fight for changing planning laws and fight for change in education and all of these things. Than just be complicit in leaving things the way they are. I don't know why I added that. Can we please thank our three panelists? They were fantastic. And thanks to everybody for coming.
You've been listening to an MPavilion podcast recorded on the lands of the Eastern Kulin Nation. For more, visit our archive at mpavilion.org and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.